A lot of people come to me and say, I work for a really fine company. I work hard, and I appreciate them, and I think they appreciate me. But I need to get more money. I need to get a promotion. And frankly, my company's cutting back. My company's telling people they're lucky to keep the jobs they've got. But that kind of negative psychology working against me, how can I possibly get a raise or a promotion? The answer is very simple. It goes right back to what we talked about at the beginning of this program. All you have to do is refuse to play the game of employment by the same rules all your counterparts play by. Don't let your employer consciously or unconsciously relegate you to the role of a commodity. Make yourself a proprietary, and by that I mean make yourself distinctive and invaluable. Sit down and analyze what your value has been to the employer, tangibly, measurably, specifically, in whatever terms best denominates the value and the tangible benefit and result that employer gets from every day, every hour that you work. In other words, what the correlation is to what you do to what the outcome is. And maybe all you can correlate is the number of papers you process, or the number of calls you take, or the number of claims you settle, or the number of customer service calls you dispatch or you go out on. But there's got to be a correlation. Once you have that correlation, I'd love for you to be able to comparatively know what it looks like against everybody else's. In other words, if you accomplish 100 service calls a day and your closest competitor does 80, that means you are 20% superior just in base performance. But it may mean that the employer gets something like $1,000 to $2,000 worth of greater achievement from you every day. Once you know that value, you can then go to your employer and say one of three things. Number one, look, I understand business is down. I understand times are tough and you've got to keep your costs very, very well managed. But I don't think anybody in this company, because I know I didn't even know it, realizes that I accomplish 20% more every day than anyone else I work with. And that 20% more accomplishes for the company $2,000 more a day. I'm getting 10% less than the best person that I work with, and it's not fair. I need a raise. I'd like you to give me a raise on the merit that I am underpaid right now, but I'd like to make the investment in me worth your while, because I'd like to guarantee if you'll do that, I will give you an even greater performance every day of every week of every month. If I fail to give you at least 10% improved performance evaluated on a 30-day or 90-day basis, you can take any raise you give me away. And by that I'm saying, be the one person in your job category who demands that your employer judges you on the tangible contributions you make. Promise them an even greater achievement if they will reward you just for what you've already done and the superior level of performance you've done it at. Tell them if you don't achieve and maintain that level, they can take any reward they give you now away. No one's ever done that. It's the easiest way I know. Sit on the same side of the desk as a bottom-line P&L-oriented employer would. Say, look, let's not talk about my passion for the company. Let's not talk about the years of loyalty. Let's not talk about my abstract skill. Let's talk about bottom-line, tangible, black-and-white numbers. Let's talk about what I achieve in profit, in calls, in results, in productivity that no one else in the company does, and let's talk about how much more I will promise in writing I will achieve if I get what I want. If you do that, you'll blow them away. A lot of people ask me, how do I get more power and money out of my career? Well, I've already basically explained it to you, but let me refocus it in terms of this question. First of all, you stop falling in love with yourself and what's in it for you. You start falling in love with your employer and what you can do to make your contribution to them more productive, more valuable, and you make sure they understand that. And if you don't know, you get them to help you know, and you get both sides, you and them, to start analyzing and tracking it. And if you haven't tracked it, you start coming up with a system and a formula to identify, measure, and continually correlate what contribution you can make to that business on an ongoing basis. Number two, you find out how many more ways you can add value to the employer. You don't do it abstractly. You sit down and say, look, I want more out of this job, and I know I can't get more if I don't give more. So I want to work together to figure what I have to do to be worth five times what you're paying me, so maybe you'll pay me three times what I'm getting now. I need to know where I can make the highest contribution. I need to know where I can do the most for you. I need to know where I can save you the most money or add the most profit or get more done every day or get more customers in the door. You have to help me get directed. Make it a collaborative process. What normally happens in times like this is employees and employers sort of take on an attitude of every person for themselves, thus us against them. You've got to be the one person you've got to be the one person in the organization that breaks ranks. You've got to be the one person that says, I'm in this for your well-being, but I can't even give you the highest level of my capacity to contribute unless you help me. And by taking on that attitude, both in words and actions, it'll only be a matter of time before you will become so powerful and so enriched in your job that you will have outgrown it and probably grown and leapfrogged yourself many times over. A lot of people don't want to keep their job. Frankly, they've worked as long as they want for another employer. They want to be independent. They want to be on their own. They want to start a business from scratch. They don't know what business to start. I've got a very simple philosophy. It's worked about 950 times out of 960. I suspect it'll work for you. Don't try to buy a business. Don't try to start a business from scratch. The odds of starting a business from scratch and succeeding, if it's a brand new business you have no familiarity with, are probably 1 in 30. That means there is a 29 out of 30, or I don't know what the inverse fraction is, but it's massive. It's probably a 96% probability you will not succeed. You will fail. I don't like those odds. I like 90 or 95% certainty. There's no 100% certainty, but you can get 95% certainty. How do you do it? Go back to your old faithful, the Yellow Pages, and start calling on, first of all, go back to the Yellow Pages, your old faithful. Look up categories of business that look like they would be enjoyable, fun, fulfilling, worthwhile, satisfying, something you could really get into long-term. Decide on which ones have the highest easy entry levels. In other words, something you can get into with the least amount of learning curve and the least amount of capital contribution. Then get on the phone and call people in those businesses who tend to be localized. Tell them the truth, that you're quitting your job or you're out of work and you're thinking of starting a business in that field. Tell them you will never be a competitor and you want to pick their mind. You want to ask them 10 questions. First question should be, if you had to do it again, would you go into this business today? If the answer is yes, say why. If it's no, ask them why. Ask them what they love about it. Ask them what they don't love about it. Ask them where the biggest opportunity lies. Ask them where the biggest pitfall lies. Ask them, if you were trying to get started in that business and had very little money and very little skills, what their recommendation would be for the easiest, fastest path to success and profit certainty and the way to avoid problems, losses, and frustration. Ask them if they have any aspect of the business they have never pursued that they'd like to joint venture with you. If you do this 100 times over, three things will happen. Number one, you'll see certain businesses you might have thought of going in not being as exciting or fulfilling or promising as you'd expected. You'll uncover all kinds of promising businesses you've never thought about, and you'll probably have to turn down more joint venture, profit, business, and partnership opportunities than you ever imagined possible. A lot of people come to me at the end of the spring and they say, Jay, I really want to develop a method for helping my children become more self-reliant. Come up with some money-making opportunities my kids can get into
on the weekends and the evenings and the summers.
Well, I think that's very commendable, but I think you've got to go back to a philosophy of making your children excited about being entrepreneurs. Getting children excited about the chance they have to add value, to bring a benefit or an advantage to people's lives. Because when they realize that all society is based on financially is our ability to add value and benefit to someone or some organization's life or situation, it's very exciting. So if you ask your children, how can you add value to somebody's lives, it gets really exciting. Start in your neighborhood. Make a list of all the things they could do for the neighbors. First thing they could do is cut grass. The second thing they could do is wash windows. The third thing they could do is take care of the animals. The fourth thing they could do is house sit. The fifth thing they could do is odds and ends, change lights, clean garages. Well, if the children are young, just by going up and down the neighborhood and setting up a regular route-type service to do that and asking all the neighbors if they would let you call them every week to see if they needed any of those things done, or asking if they'd like those things done on a regular weekly, biweekly, or monthly basis, it's a numbers game. If they do it sincerely and they do it with a focus towards the fact that they want to add greater value, they want to do a service, they want to provide a benefit, they want to do something worthwhile for that homeowner or that neighbor, the odds are that statistically, one out of a certain minimum number of people will say yes. I can tell you a secret, and that is the more your children come from a position that they really want to do a great job, they really want to see that neighbor's yard look good, they really want to see the neighbor's car look good, they really want to see the neighbor's house look clean, they really want to see all the lights in, they really want to see the dog or the animal healthy and fed and watered, they really want to see the grass really grow well, the neighbor will pick up on that and be very excited. Most children don't try to turn a chore or an activity into a business. It's a mindset. If they get it into a business mode, your children actually will be creating something they could sell. It has asset value. Ask yourself this question. If you had a route of 50 or 100 homes in the neighborhood that had you calling on them every week to cut the grass and once a month to put light bulbs in that were burnt out, and every time they went on vacation to feed and take care of the animals, and once a year clean out the garage and do other things, all of a sudden your child has a $100 or $200 or $300 a week income stream that he or she can do year in and year out and make a ton of money in the summer. And if they ever get tired of it, they could literally sell it to another child for either a lump sum or for a share of the revenue. That's great training. So the first thing I try to do is get the child to look at what business or what money-making is really all about. And it's all about adding value, bringing an advantage, wanting an improved result for somebody. Then I get them to look through the neighborhood. After they look through the neighborhood, I then have them look to the business community in the neighborhood. There are going to be offices. There are going to be retail. What do retailers need? They need, A, someone to do their windows. They need, B, someone to clean the place. They need, C, someone to deliver and run errands for them. They need, E, someone to work part-time. They need, F, someone to handle shipments, labor, and on and on. If you make a list of all the things they could need and your son or daughter or children go to those retailers and, again, offer a regular service, not just a question, do you need anything? Because when you ask if someone needs anything, the answer is almost always no. But if you put it in the terms of an ongoing service, a benefit that you offer them on a regular basis with the knowledge that there needs change, that you, meaning your son or daughter, knows that from time to time that retailer is going to be in a position where they're going to need their windows cleaned, or their windows decorated, or their floors cleaned, or merchandise moved, or boxes packed or unpacked, or extra labor available for special deliveries, the odds of developing a route of business is very high. After the retailers, then you go to the offices. And you think about services offices need. They need someone to get them lunches. They need someone to run errands. They need someone to pick up things. They need someone to deliver things, packages. They need someone to go to the store, go to the office, supply places. You could develop a route. And on and on and on. And after you've done all of that, or your children have done all of that, if they're still in need of something, guess where they can turn? Ta-da! The Yellow Pages. And they can call everybody in the Yellow Pages, and they can try one of the following. Number one, they can ask them, do you need somebody to be a 2 or 3 hour a day jack of all trades? We can run errands, we can clean things, we can pack boxes. That's the first thing. Number two, they can think of specific services they can do. They can basically pick up and deliver quick printing. They can pick up and deliver lunch every day. I have a friend whose wife makes $2,000 a month picking up and delivering lunches for office buildings in the area. Why couldn't your son or daughter do that? It's certainly in the summertime. And on and on. On. Again, the purpose of this program is to start you and your family in a different way of thinking, a different mindset, a different focus, where you realize you have always had, and you currently have, and you always will have, 100% of the ability to accomplish everything and anything you ever want in your life, in your job, in your career, in the money-making arena, in business, in the professions. All you have to do is stop self-limiting. Let's talk about money hobbies. It's a phrase I use to define how you can take areas of your personal life, skill sets, interests, things you are fascinated with or excel at, and turn it into full or part-time revenue streams. These money hobbies are the most joyous and easiest form of increased revenue you will ever take advantage of. How do you do it? Well, first thing is you recognize that every human being I have ever met excels at least one additional area other than what they do at work. In other words, you have a skill. It may be a memory. It may be a athletic prowess. It may be a green thumb and you're a great gardener. It may be your understanding of a hobby. It may be a sport. It may be a skill. It may be some part of literature. But make a list of whatever area or areas of personal interest you excel at. Once you've made your list, then ask yourself, how many other people would love to learn how to do what you already understand at the level you understand it? In other words, how many people can you teach to do what you do and as good as you do? How many people could you train? How many people could you coach? How many key people could you work with? How many people could you share your understandings with? How do you do that? Well, you have a number of ways. Number one is you become a tutor or a coach. You go to areas or organizations or groups of people that you know would like to know what you do. And you go to groups and areas of high concentration where you know there are a lot of people who would love to learn what you excel at. For example, let's say that you've got the ability to grow flowers twice as high and 4 times thicker and more colorful than the average gardener. It would seem like you could go to Gardening Magazine or you could go to almost any consumer publication with an ad or a press release and talk about your ability and talk about your secret and offer to train people privately by phone, at your home, at their home, or by letter, and get a lot of people who would call upon you. It seems like if you understood how to play golf better than most people, you could probably coach people or hold a seminar or write a book or a report or do an audio or a videotape and offer it for sale. You could offer it for sale in the golf magazines. You could offer it for sale through the golf stores. You could offer it for sale through the golf clubs. You could offer it for sale all kinds of ways. Believe me, between being a tutor, a coach, a seminar giver, an author, a tape creator, an expert who made his or her services available by the hour, by the day, by the achievement, by the accomplishment, by the group, you could make more money from your hobby or God-given skill than you even do from your mainstream income. And you could do it at your convenience. You could do it at night. You could do it on weekends. You could do it on vacations. You could do it by mail. You could do it by telephone. You could do it in groups. You could do it one-on-one. You could teach other people to do it for you. I basically became so good, for example, at marketing consulting, I taught 1,000 people how to do it for themselves, and some of them taught other people how to do it for them. I have a friend who's great, absolutely great, at running a very profitable legal practice with one assistant. He makes $1 million a year. He teaches other attorneys how to do that. I have a friend who absolutely understands how to live his life so stress-free, it's unbelievable. He never set out to do that as a livelihood, but so many people prevailed upon him that he started teaching classes on the weekends, and now he makes tons and tons of money doing that when he's not working. I have a friend who is an impeccably great cook. She teaches other women through cooking classes. She's got a book she's written. She's got a tape set that she sells. You're only limited by your imagination and, guess what, the Yellow Pages, or in a bigger picture, a directory of appropriate businesses around the country, around the world. Because once you figure out what your money hobby skills are, you don't have anyone keeping you from selling them nationally, internationally, globally. All you have to do is get a directory of where the highest concentration of most probable prospects for that skill set are. And as I say, if, for example, you have a talent that's real easy to target, like gardening, all you do is find all the gardening magazines and the gardening publications and the gardening groups and the gardening clubs, and you offer that. If your skill is in relaxation, you might have to go to people who buy stress products or stress reduction products, or just people in industries you know tend to be stressed out, and go to people who tend to work with them and see if they would refer people to you. Anyhow, the point is this. You absolutely have money hobbies. You owe it to yourself and your skills and your God-given talents to cultivate and offer to other people who aren't as gifted and as successful at doing it as you. I encourage you to do that. Now I'd like to talk about something anybody at any level of their life can utilize to accomplish a rather miraculous improvement in their circumstances. Specifically, I'm talking about how you can increase your standard of living without changing jobs. Most people don't realize that you can get the same result of making more money by acquiring things at a lower price. I've gotten tons of people to redirect their thoughts on quality of living issues away from making more money and over to accomplishing more with the money and the efforts they currently expend, I'd like to do the same for you. I want to talk about this philosophy of increasing your standard of living without changing jobs. First of all, let's ask ourselves this question. What has to happen in your life for your standard of living to improve? Well, either you want to live in a nicer place, or you want to do more things, or you want to have more things, or you want to go to nicer places, or you want to congregate with higher qualities of people, right? Right. Let's take ones individually and ask ourselves, if we didn't make more money, how else could we accomplish the same goal? Well, the first thing I want to introduce you to is a philosophy of barter or trading. Because by identifying what products or services you can create and produce that other people desire, you have the capacity to create purchasing power and value at will. Let's say, for example, you work at a business and you are an accountant. Maybe there's a restaurant in your neighborhood or in your city that you'd love to start going out to every Friday, but you know if you did that, the bill would probably be $400 or $500 a month, and your budget doesn't allow for that. But what if you went to that restaurant and you said, I will trade you accounting services for your restaurant in exchange for $700 or $1,000 worth of food and beverage credit for me and my family or my dates every month? Let's say it took you a few hours a week of your time and your ability. Hours that you normally would use to watch television or read a book or lounge around the house or drive into the shopping malls. For that investment of hours, you would accomplish the exact objective you desired. You would increase your standard of living, or at least one aspect of it, because you'd be able to go neat places without spending any more money. What else could you trade? Well, you could trade things. How do you do that? You could either create. A lot of people have the capacity to produce value, but they don't normally sell that. I know people who are artisans at building things, cabinetry, wall decor. You could go to organizations who would really benefit by having you produce those kinds of things for them and trade them for the products or services they sell. I knew a gentleman, for example, who did all kinds of artistic decor for a prominent hotel in his city, and he got in exchange credit not at that hotel but at a sister hotel in Hawaii. He was able to go on vacation 3 times a year, basically only pay for his airfare. And I taught him how to trade artistic decor for the office of a travel agency that paid him an airfare, so he was able to do all of it for nothing. The question is, what else could you trade? Products, services, skill sets, or things you could acquire from other people that you could have traded to get you the objective you want? That's the first thing. The second thing is, what could you negotiate for? Now, negotiation is an overlooked aspect of lifestyle that most of us don't really think a lot about. We are very sale-oriented, and we are very discount-oriented, but we don't realize that 90% of the products and services that are for sale in this country can be negotiated for. Case in point. I just came back from spending a weekend in Palm Springs at a very luxurious tennis resort. I stayed in a suite. The suite cost me, $650 a night. I'm going to show my hypocrisy. A friend that I met there for a business meeting is a better negotiator than I am. He went to the manager before he arrived and negotiated a rate for himself and his wife for the exact comparable two-bedroom suite for $325. In other words, he paid exactly 50% of what I did because he asked. He found out that the suite was available. He told them nicely that he was going to come to Palm Springs, and he either would stay in that suite for $325 or he would go to a deal he had at a comparable hotel across the street. He told the manager that he need not wait. He need not give him a decision until he arrived. And my friend had a similar arrangement with three other hotels. What did he accomplish? He accomplished the lifestyle, the quality or standard of living of my $650 expenditure for $325. Almost everything is negotiable, from doctor bills to restaurant bills to you name it. The trick is negotiating before, not after, you render the service and having a hedge or an alternative if someone turns you down. And the trick is knowing when to negotiate and when not. If a restaurant is absolutely packed on Friday nights, the time to negotiate with them is not for Friday night dinner. But if they are empty on Monday night and you go to the restaurant ahead and say, look, I typically go out on Friday nights, but it doesn't really matter to me if I go out on Monday and you're more available, I am willing to come on Monday when you can accommodate me instead on Friday when you probably can't even accept my reservation, and I will be additional revenue you never would have had, and I'll do that if you will let me order off the menu and when the check arrives, reduce my bill by 40%. Now, every restaurant won't say yes, but you'll be surprised at how many would. You'll be surprised if you go to a restaurant and say, I'm going to come there 10 times a year. I want a 10-time discount rate, and if I fail to achieve that, you can short rate me or bill me back for the full rate. If you don't ask, you don't get. But if you can reduce your expenses on restaurants by 30 or 40%, if you can reduce your cost of vacation resorts by 30 to 60%, if you can negotiate preferential deals on all kinds of other goods or services, including clothing, including jewelry, including all kinds of things that most people would not negotiate with and for, you get the effective result of having an income that's 30 to 50% higher. The point, it's to look for leverage. Look for situations where the other side, meaning what you want and who you want it from, has more to gain than even you do by accepting your business at a preferred rate or advantage. And believe me, in about 90% of the situations, you will find a time, a place, a category of product or service where the company is more distressed than you would imagine. By that I mean they have too much product. They have no one using it. They have vacancies. They have oversupply. And you can approach them with a simple negotiating positioning. It should be this or a derivative. I respect the value of your product, and I know that normally you get every cent of what you ask. And I don't deny that to you. I respect it. I'm sure it's worth every cent. However, I don't require it at the level of desire that some of your other customers or clients do. I think it would be nice to have or use or acquire, depending on the product or service you're talking about. But if I never get it, it's not the end of the world. On the other hand, if there's a way I can help you gain an advantage you wouldn't have, and I can benefit in the process, and we can both do each other a nice service that pleases me. And with that, then you lead to the scenario. It could be that at the end of the season or coming to the end of the season, or a retailer is looking to, or a retailer has an oversupply of a certain kind of clothing or footwear, and you can say, I am willing to buy twice as many as I normally would if you'll give me half price. Now, I know you probably won't make much money, but you'll reduce your inventory and you'll get cash. If cash is important, and the thought of me having the capacity to come back again is appealing, if reducing your inventory and getting cash has value, and knowing that I am willing to buy future items from you at retail or at least close to it, and I will never breach the sanctity of the transaction that we have, then I'd like you to consider it. And it's over, open for consideration, and all I ask is you think about it and let me know. Or when I come in, you can say I've thought about it and I'll gladly accept it, or I don't. If you always approach transactions with the evident willingness to walk away, in other words, not being rigid or curt, but being enthusiastic, but not that hell-bent on doing the deal unless the other side is equally as willing, and approaching it the same way I suggested you approach everything, as a service to the other side. And there really is situations where it is a service. There are a lot of companies that have oversupply of product, underutilization of manufacturing. The best possible way for this to work is if you'll adopt the same basic mindset and strategy that I've suggested you incorporate in all the other methods and ideas I've shared in this program, and that is focusing on what's in the best interest of the other side. If you want a car, know that there are certain times of the year where car dealers are loaded. If you want to rent a car, say you've always wanted a convertible but you really can't afford one, you could go to a rental company and say, any week it looks like the convertibles aren't rented, I would rent it from you for 40% of rate. And show them that at 40% of rate, they cover their insurance, they cover their depreciation, you'll cover their you'll have your own insurance, and it's found revenue. Tell them, obviously, in the peak times, in the heart of the summer, then you won't rent it from them. But whenever they're not using it, if it's available to you at 40% of rate, it's revenue they wouldn't have gotten. And if you take that attitude in many, 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 not all, but most situations, your sincerity melded to a genuine willingness to be discreet, and you'll always treat it as if you paid full rate and respect them accordingly, you'll be surprised at how much more you'll be able to acquire and enjoy in life. So the first thing you can do is see how you can trade products or services. The next thing you can do is negotiate. The third strategy, and it's a little bit of a kindred relative to the second one, is go to people, merchants, companies, service companies, and offer them trial relationship propositions. Let me give you an example of what I mean. Let's say you wanted to be a member of a prominent tennis club, but you don't have the $10,000 to join, and you can't necessarily afford the $500 a month. But your career looks promising. Well, if you went to them and you were honest and you said, I think I would be a great future member. Right this moment, I don't have the $10,000, nor can I afford the $500, but I'd like to suggest that you create a modified special trial membership for me. It'll be a 9-month membership to see if I like you and you like me. At the end of that 9 months, I will either go forward or I will drop out. But during that 9 months, in essence, I get an option to experience the services, and I will only use them a maximum of 2 days a week, and I will gladly pay you $100 a month. I will use them on days you tell me are the lightest so it doesn't take away from other members. I will eat at least once in the restaurant and pay the additional cost of that, so it will be additional revenue you'll get. I will respect my membership and treat it as if I had paid $10,500. At the end of that period, the very least you will have gotten is 6 months' worth of revenue and restaurant charges. I will bring a high quality of people as my guests to the club. At the end, if I want to go forward, I may ask you to allow me to have payment terms on the down payment. But the worst thing that will happen is you'll have a high quality of person using the facilities in a non-critical, non-peak time period, and I will be an asset to the membership. Now, everyone won't say yes, but you'll be surprised at how many will. And the trick is find modified ways to allow people to change their pricing, change their terms, change their access to you. Health clubs. There's a lot of health clubs I have persuaded to create an off-hours membership. You can go and do the same thing. Say, I understand it's $1,000 a year to be a member, but I'd like to join, and I'll guarantee I'll come off hours, or I'll only come 2 days a week. And tell them if it continues and you want to go more, you'll convert to a full-term membership. Once you start, most of them will let you continue forever. That has been my experience. I've gone to scalping companies, people who sell scalping tickets, and said, call me when you're stuck with tickets, and I will buy them from you at the last minute for 50% of rate. Well, I got calls for tickets that normally, when they're really desirable, people would pay 3 and 4 and 5 times over face value for. And if I'm patient and flexible, I would get calls once at least a month where I was offered tickets at half or less price. Now, I had to be willing to respond the same day, but my wife and I were flexible. The same with a gentleman that I know who sells packages of tours on cruise lines. He's got a standing offer from me. Anytime he gets stuck with a cruise at the last moment, he is to call me, and if I'm available, I will get the cruise for approximately 35% of what everyone else pays for. Well, if everyone else is on the boat for $4,000 and I'm on the boat for $1,000, I'm having the same experience. I'm having the same, quote, quality of life, or living at the same standard that they are, but I'm paying 65% less. This is just a start for you, a springboard of thinking, but it's based or predicated on the assumption that you recognize you have the right and the opportunity to change the rules by which you have to deal with any supplier, any vendor, any retailer, any clothier, any service company, any prestige vendor of products or services again. If you call, for example, the hottest hair salon in town and you say, you know, I would love to have you cut my hair, but I can't afford the $125. I can't afford $40. I know it's an insult, but if you ever have a slow day or a slow week, and you'd be willing, I would be so flattered to have my hair cut by you. And I associate with some very influential and high-caliber people. Unfortunately, most of them are much better off financially than I am, but I'm a dear friend. And the fact that you give me a great haircut can't hurt getting them interested in you. And I guarantee I'll give you a tip that was as good as you'll get from someone who pays $100 and a quarter. Well, if you said that to every expensive hairdresser, probably some would say no. But the odds of someone having an opening or a light day once a month is exceptionally high. If you approach it sincerely and genuinely with an avid respect and desire for
for their service, I suspect you'll end up getting $125 hair treatments and haircuts for about $35. I can go on and on, but I hope you get the idea. There is nothing that says you have to satisfy yourself with the quality of living your current income would normally justify. By restructuring the terms, the basis, the pricing, the consideration, the way you approach it, your ability to give the other side something else they want or could appreciate, including respect and your appreciation. Because a lot of people basically love to be loved. If you go to somebody and say, gosh, I'd love to eat at your restaurant, but I can't afford it, but I can't afford half that rate, and I'd be willing to eat there at the slowest time of the week or the month. I'd be willing to eat there if you called and said you had a cancellation at the last minute. I would just love to eat there. The truth of the matter is you can have so much fun doubling or tripling the quality of life and the standard of living you enjoy. So have at it. Have fun. The world is literally your own bowl of cherries the moment you realize you don't have to play the game at full retail.
Please go to the next tape in this series.